Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
This hour, getting beyond the politicized rhetoric of gentrification. Now, it's become a bad word with a lot of negative connotations, but the research on gentrification gives us a more nuanced picture. There are neighborhoods and cities, including here in the Twin Cities, where lower-income people have been forced out as higher-income people brought new businesses and higher rents and taxes with them. There are also places where lower-income residents were not displaced and indeed benefited as the neighborhood slowly improved. I have been reading up on a Cleveland Federal Reserve study that finds that gentrification is nowhere near as widespread as you believe. So, our guests are here to lead the conversation with me, and I'd like to hear from you. If you live in a city neighborhood that has been changing, are the changes affecting you in a positive or a negative way? Are you part of the change? Maybe you can no longer pay the rent. Maybe the value of your home has climbed. Tell me how these changes look to you from where you are. So talk to us a little bit about the neighborhood that you live in, how you're seeing the changes happen in that neighborhood, how they look from you. And if you're part of that change, I think your voice would be really valuable in the conversation as well. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 if you're somewhere in the region, and on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Pastor Tyler Sitt is with me in the studio. He's the pastor at New City Church in Minneapolis, where they focus on addressing gentrification. Welcome. Really good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Brittany Lewis is with us. She's a PhD research associate at the Center for Urban and Regional Affairs at the University of Minnesota, and she's with us from Minneapolis. And Brittany, welcome to you. It's good to have you here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Tyler also gave me permission to drop the pastor and, okay, good, thank you. So Brittany, I think it's worth starting with an academic definition of gentrification because it's such a loaded term, and I think we tend to put our own experience and our own views onto it. Tell me how you, for the purposes of your research, how you define gentrification.
Okay, so when we approach this study, we were very intentional to make clear to all our partners and those folks that we've worked with thus far that the goal was not to define it. But what we do say when we do speak with folks is that in order for a place to gentrify, it has to have historically been disinvested in. So places that are historically filled with wealth cannot gentrify. We argue, you know, as scholars across the country, that the definition of gentrification is a contested debate. You know, for that reason, when we did our quantitative research, we didn't choose one scholar's definition of gentrification and or their ways of measuring gentrification. We actually took three different measurements of gentrification and we mapped it over the Twin Cities and we said if two out of the three matched, did those places were vulnerable to gentrification, because scholars don't agree on the definition.
Okay.
So we have taken that approach, which we argue is fairly conservative, to the quantitative analysis of gentrification, because the base assumption is a place has to have been historically disinvested in to gentrify, and then scholars across the board disagree on some level about at what percentage, whether it's poverty or increases of median income or house value, does that define that a place has gentrified. Scholars do not agree about that.
I think this is a good way to get into this. What we all can say to start out here, Tyler, is it is a neighborhood or a place that has been traditionally disinvested in, as Brittany says. Would you add anything to that for our working, parameters here for the conversation?
Yeah, of course, a lot of my experience as a pastor is more qualitative than quantitative.
Yep.
But something that is characteristic of the stories that I'm hearing in our neighborhood is a narrative of race and displacement, and how these historically disinvested neighborhoods are often neighborhoods of color, and how those same residents who built that neighborhood are displaced when wealthier and often whiter residents come in.
So, Brittany, does the research support the idea that this is how you know it's gentrification. People who have lived there, who have been disinvested in, who are often low income, often people of color, are forced out as the neighborhood gentrifies. Does the research support that that's usually the outcome when changes are happening in a given neighborhood?
Yes, the research does support, you know, that claim. And our research specifically here in Minneapolis actually pushes us even further. You know, I want to clarify, when we're talking about gentrification, there's this natural next step to displacement. And for a lot of policymakers, it's you need to prove that physical displacement is taking place for many folks to actually move the dial on creating policy or change in a very tangible kind of way. But I would argue that what low-income folks and folks of color are experiencing goes far beyond just physical displacement. It goes from cultural, economic, and political displacement, which our report and our work really wants to ensure becomes a central part of the conversation, because displacement isn't always physical.
Okay. I think this is important. What I hear you saying, Tyler, check me on this, is there is more than one measure of this, and we shouldn't just believe that the only way to measure it is if people are forced out and they have to go live somewhere else.
Absolutely. Yes. I think that in a lot of the neighborhoods that I work in South Minneapolis, people describe a sense of ownership and a sense of place as the neighborhood is a neighborhood of color. And even before they're displaced out, culturally, there's a sense of loss of place and a loss of this feeling like home. Mm-hmm. And that is also a type of cultural violence, even though it's harder to measure and it's harder to make policy around.
Call here from Brian in Minneapolis. Hi, Brian. Tell me what you're seeing in your neighborhood.
I live just between Glenwood and Highway 55, so we've got at least one light rail line getting ready to come through. I've noticed that my property value has gone up close to $70,000 in the last 8 years. And what I'm seeing is the lack of modification of the homestead value process has almost doubled my taxes, property taxes on the house in the time that I've owned it. And I see that as one of those things that doesn't get discussed very much, that is probably pretty impacting into, you know, I have a very multicultural neighborhood, and I'm really getting the feeling that my neighbors are probably going to start getting to a point where they can't afford their taxes.
Okay. When you said a lack of modification of the homesteading process, what are you talking about?
Well, there's a base value on the homestead that I believe it's the initial $74,000, which is taxed at a lower rate. And then anything on above that value on
right.
the property is taxed at a higher rate.
Right.
Well, in the research that I've done, that $74,000 hasn't changed in probably close to 15 years, but the property values are all going up and up and up. So there's no that you're paying a bigger chunk of taxes on that value. And to me, that seems like almost like a retrograde taxing increase on a yearly basis that is not getting addressed.
Brittany, is this something that you looked at in research about how people were experiencing the changes that were happening, especially when it comes to property value?
Yes. So in addition to our quantitative analysis, I was also in charge of doing a full-scale qualitative analysis. So when we pursued that analysis, we asked, do our quantitative indexes match what residents are perceiving? So we actually narrowed down to five cluster neighborhoods, north, south, northeast, and two areas in St. Paul. And in north, we focused on the Willard Hay and Harrison neighborhood, which is exactly where Brian lives. And we talked to residents and business owners, long-term residents, and renters of color to see what they were experiencing. 100% of the folks that we talked to talked about increasing rents and home values, uh-huh. identifying financial costs as a concern that's taking place over time. We've also mapped over time how property values and taxes have changed, and they have certainly increased.
Yeah, Brittany, I want to add for listeners here that you did this series of interviews in your research on gentrification with, 58 different interviews where people felt like they were experiencing this?
Interviews with local residents, and we did about 30 interviews with local public officials.
Did you find that people told, beyond the housing value thing here, because I'm conscious of what you said before, there's a lot of different ways to feel displaced. Did you find that most of that perception of gentrification was focusing on, hey, when I have to pay for rent or what I have, you know, what my property taxes are going to look like? Or were you hearing a lot of different input about, I just don't feel like it's my neighborhood anymore and that I have the kind of what agency in the neighborhood that I used to have?
100%. So we're really intentional in our report to talk about the narrative commonalities across all clusters and the narrative distinctions. So across all clusters, 100% of folks talked about increased rents. 88% of folks talked about increased presence of whiteness. 67% talked about a younger population moving in. Mm-hmm. And 72% talked about displacement fears. Okay, that happened across all neighborhoods. However, in the different clusters, there was these distinct narratives that came up. So in North Minneapolis, particularly in the Willard Hay and Harrison neighborhood, a lot of folks talked about a lack of community-based ownership as a sign of gentrification, i.e. folks that have been owning buildings and buying up properties in North are not from North and often capitalizing on economic growth. They talked about historic designation being used as a tool of gentrification to make one's place exclusive and then thus unaffordable for some folks. In South Minneapolis, it was really, really popular. Two things, the fear of quote-unquote uptowning as a verb, and also new businesses coming in that aren't matching what historic residents need, from the $20 candle shop to the upscale coffee shop that, you know, most folks, you know, can't afford. In Northeast, a place that has undoubtedly gentrified, folks talk about how much they paid in rent 10 years ago and what they're being forced to pay now. And artists talk about not being able to afford live workspace and now are being forced to the suburbs.
Let me do this, Brittany. I've been taking notes here as you've been talking about this, and it's a lot to cover. I want to break some of this down. Tyler, when you hear people say, I don't want our neighborhood to be uptowning, or I'm seeing it uptowning, what does that really say to you? I mean, what are residents of the neighborhood saying?
Absolutely. So New City works with the Phillips, Powderhorn, and Central neighborhoods in South Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And I certainly hear what Dr. Lewis was mentioning, a fear of uptowning. And what they mean by that, and apologies to the people who live in uptown. I know your neighborhood is amazing. But
hear from people who live in uptown.
Right.
What's wrong with this?
That's right. What I mean by that is there's a certain commercialization that feels more comfortable, but it takes away the soul of what makes a city a city. Like what makes a city is this amazing diversity of economic and racial people, diversity coming together to innovate and create culture. And what we're seeing in neighborhoods like Uptown is the standardization and commercialization of industry that removes the specific character of the neighborhood.
So when you say standardization, are you saying the chains that might pop up in this neighborhood are the kind of chains that you can find in Uptown and a lot of other neighborhoods? It's nothing against, I just want to be clear.
Absolutely.
It's nothing against investment in businesses. Maybe a new cafe opens. Maybe it doesn't look like the place that's, you know, three blocks down. But what you're worried about is this ends up looking like chain kind of places and a certain homogeneity to the neighborhood.
Yeah, that homogeneity is a good word. And I would just say, you're right, we're not afraid of investment, but it's investment by whom and for whom. And so if it's investment to benefit the people who have built up this neighborhood for decades, then we welcome that. But if it's investment for the specter of a more affluent whiteness who wants to come into the neighborhood, then that's no longer maintaining the character of the neighborhood that activists and culture creators have been working for decades to create.
How do you know that, though? I mean, I guess I would ask, do you know it when you see it? And that's kind of the definition of it's appealing to whiteness, and so we're clearly appealing to more white people to come into the neighborhood. I mean, how do you define that?
Yeah, I think it's easy for me to just talk to, you know, 10 people walking by an establishment on the street, and you get a pretty clear idea of who this establishment is for. I also know that some new investments in the neighborhood have been very clear about having community benefits agreements that put into paper their hiring policies, their sourcing policies to make sure that they're reinvesting in the neighborhood that they're benefiting from.
If you're listening to the conversation, you hear us talking about gentrification, and I actually think you get an indication here of why this is a pretty complicated issue. I mean, the word itself carries a negative connotation, but there's a lot to talk about here. It's not as simple as, well, new businesses came in and new homeowners came in and they forced people out. We're talking about the political implications of this and the cultural kind of feel of the neighborhood, and then just straight ahead, that can people still afford rents and purchases and property taxes in those neighborhoods. Reverend Tyler Sitt is with us. He's a pastor at New City Church in Minneapolis. This is a big focus for them. And Brittany Lewis is with us. She's a PhD research associate at the Center for Urban and Regional Affairs at the University of Minnesota. I really would like to hear your experience with this. If you live in a city neighborhood that has been changing, are the changes affecting you in a positive or negative way? I mean, some of the research says people who have lived in some of these neighborhoods for a while say if it's done well, our property values go up and this is valuable to us. If it's not done well, we feel like we're being pushed out in a lot of different ways. So I want to hear your experience with it. How do the changes look from where you are? 800-242-2828 from wherever you are in the metro or the region, 651-227-6000, and on Twitter at CarrieNPR. To Mark in downtown Minneapolis. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Downtown Minneapolis has gone through really four major developments over the past 200 years. You have to remember downtown is really the oldest part of the city here.
Uh-huh.
And especially along Washington Avenue, if you've driven along, especially South Washington Avenue, you've seen changes over the past few decades. Back in the 1960s, before the public meeting laws, they basically came through and clear cut. It was a lot of flop houses and indigent housing is pretty much what it was. Housing for the poor, et cetera. But back in the 60s, they were allowed to just come in, cut it all down, and just make parking lots out of everything. Eventually, you had a little housing unit pop up here and there, and a few businesses and such. But all of a sudden, about over the past 10 years, it's just changed dramatically. All of this real estate has been sold to developers, and it's all now high-end real estate.
Uh-huh.
All along. And you just see that there's condominiums and apartment buildings, and they're all high value, very expensive. Really not seeing any sort of things coming into play for moderate or working class people.
Yeah.
So I'm quite surprised by this. Now, I've been in this neighborhood for 30 years, and I have watched it change dramatically. Back in the 1980s, when I purchased my condominium, you could literally talk people down in price because it was considered a bad or poor investment to have a condominium in downtown Minneapolis.
So, Mark, let me ask you this. Do you think, the consequence of a specific policy of the city of Minneapolis or the absence of a policy? Why do you think this happened?
I think it's been an absence of policy. When they started to look at the development that would take place, and they've had decades to deal with this with numerous city administrations, they never put any sort of policies into play that said, okay, we want to set aside this sort of this amount of land, this much property, this much within these high rises. This needs to be set aside for moderate to low income housing. And that has just been passed over by one administration after another.
Brittany, what do you think of that?
You know, I think downtown is so indicative of the shift in population or this kind of remigration taking place.
People coming back in to live in downtown, yeah.
100%. We all know the histories of kind of urban housing policy, kind of the out-migration of middle-class white folks to the suburbs, and now we have kind of the remigration and immigration of empty nesters, young white professionals, et cetera. And they're looking for, you know, urban living experience that are often connected to kind of the hustle and bustle of downtown, the arts, and all of those things. And it makes a place that was once, where this gentleman said you could barter for prices, high demand. Well, when there's high demand, you know, prices will increase.
And Brittany, how would you answer what I asked Mark about, is this, you know, the city of Minneapolis not being involved where they should have been policy-wise or too controlling of what they want in downtown?
You know, I think the city of Minneapolis, like most cities, let's just be honest about how cities function, They're unapologetic about wanting to increase their tax base. They try to develop private-public relationships, to make money. But they also have to decide when they enter those relationships what are the ethics that they have to maintain community.
Yeah. Tyler, what would you say?
Yeah, so New City Church is part of the Make Homes Happen Coalition, which is around 50 nonprofit organizations, developers that are looking to find solutions for this. And I think when we talk about affordable housing, there's really a three-prong approach that I think is what we need in a solution. Preservation of existing housing that is affordable in the community, production of new affordable housing, and then protection of renters' rights. So really what we're pushing both the mayor and the city council to consider is a three-prong approach of how we can not only think about like what Mark said, building new developments for that include affordable housing, that's good, but also keeping in mind the preservation of existing affordable housing, as well as protecting the people who are most vulnerable.
Call here from Danielle in Minneapolis. Hey, Danielle, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Going well. Give me your experience. You grew up in Uptown?
Yeah, so I grew up at 35th and Fremont to working class parents. Uh-huh. And I grew up in a house that was built by my great-great-grandparents, actually. And as a kid, Uptown was a really cool place, really quirky. There was a lot going on, a lot of interesting people. And now as an adult, I still love a lot of what's going on around Lynn Lake and Uptown. And I live in Whittier. And I think, you know, for my, like, young self, I love all the new bars and restaurants, and it's pretty exciting and fun. But I also see a lot of the old neighborhood being lost, and there were a lot of really cool independent businesses back then, and there still are, but they're getting pushed out by these kind of, you know what you're saying, this uptownization. and also it's getting to the point where the neighborhood is not going to necessarily be even affordable for me anymore. And I know it's not affordable for a lot of my neighbors. And you were just talking about the equality in housing. And I think in Whittier, we have a huge problem right now where a lot of people are wanting to come and move into the neighborhood and are willing to pay really high prices to live in that neighborhood. And, you know, a lot of the Latino neighbors are having issues with being pushed out of their homes. And it's too bad. I wish there was a balance that we could find.
You know, Danielle, I think your experience is interesting with this, though, because you're also saying, I know the history of this place. But I also, as somebody who wants to live in an exciting neighborhood, I patronize some of these businesses that replaced some of the other businesses. You know, you want exciting bars to go to or interesting places to hang out, right? I kind of hear that ambivalence in your experience.
Totally. And for example, I work remotely, and sometimes I go to Lynn Hall on Lindale because I love their French toast and they got great food and it's a cool vibe and I love it. And then sometimes I go over to Bob's Java Hut because that's where I've always gone and I feel a little bit better about myself being there.
Tyler, tell me what you hear in that. Thanks for the call, Danielle. Good to have it.
Yeah, I think that something that feels counterintuitive about gentrification is that as people are seeing artisanal coffee shops come up and artisanal, you know, taco, microbrewery, Korean hybrid, all of those things are exciting and they feel good. But again, the question is always about who is this for? Like, is this appealing to a market that is broad, that develops the neighborhood, that employs the people who would most benefit from those jobs in the neighborhood? Or is this, again, for something inviting new populations into the neighborhood in hopes that the people who build this neighborhood will be displaced out of it?
So, Brittany, who decides who this is for? I think that's a great question that Tyler's asking, but then who gets to decide that?
I would argue when Northeast has, you know, the highest concentration of breweries in the state, I think you can look and see what populations are gravitating towards certain spaces and are benefiting, mm-hmm. you know, through certain investments. Who has disposable income? That's who it's for.
Okay.
So then I feel like those questions are answered as you see both what is being appealed to, who is able to get access to it, and then by nature of what's being offered and the prices of things, whether it's rents or a $5 coffee cup, who can get access to it. So we're always already talking about economics. I would argue anyone that I've spoken to wants to benefit from development, wants to benefit right. from infrastructural change. Not one person, irrespective of their walk of life, does not want to reap from those benefits. But the reality of it is that that's not possible. And as naturally affordable housing continues to decrease and we aren't as a city building at the rate of this decrease at any scale, it is an impossibility.
Call here on affordable housing from Carlos. Hey, Carlos, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hi there. Thank you. I think sometimes we conflate affordable housing with housing that's below average. And what I mean by that is there's a lot of housing stock in Minneapolis, and I'm right in the middle of buying an apartment building mm-hmm. in the south part of the city. And a lot of the interior of that thing is substandard, and they get below average rents there. And that's kind of the people speaking, saying, you know what? This isn't brand new on the inside. The parking spot, the land, has gone up in value. But the building that sits on it decays at a rate of about 1% a year. But so an average building might go 100 years.
But tell me what you mean when you say that's kind of the people speaking. What do you mean by that?
So if we build a place, anybody builds a place, a four-unit building like the mayor wants, which is fine. The guy said he wants four-unit buildings, and then he comes out with a plan, and everybody flips out. So that building should probably rent for top dollar because it's brand new. Uh-huh. Everybody likes brand new sneakers. We know that, right? Used sneakers, 5 years old, don't usually bring, unless they're collectibles, the same thing as a brand new sneaker. We can all agree on this. A 100-year-old car, unless it's a Ferrari, is nearly worthless. And yet, a 100-year-old house is somehow quaint. It's substandard. It does not have sprinklers. It might have lead pipes. These are not good things for people. Every once in a while, these do need to be bulldozed, and new buildings do need to be built.
Carlos, can you stay on the line? Do you have a couple minutes? I'd like you to hear what Tyler has to say about that.
I mean, I think that what Carlos is saying is right in that when we advocate for affordable housing, we also have to include the adjective safe and stable, right? Like, we have heard stories of slumlords in Minneapolis that aren't addressing black mold or cockroaches or lead pipes. And no one wants to live in that housing, for sure. I think what we're advocating for is preserving housing that doesn't have those significant problems, but still has a dimension of affordability so that people can stay in the community that they built.
Carlos, how does that sound?
It sounds good. A guy that I met recently, he was working for Better Futures Minnesota, and they unbuild houses and then they sell the wood and stuff like that. That guy was really exceptional because he saw the picture the other way. He goes, I can't afford a lot of places because I just got out of prison and I got to finish my GED. And then I will be able to get a better job. I will be able to get wages to get better housing. We also have to admit it's not just, hey, rent's too high, right? It's not just that. It's maybe in such a good job market where there's nothing but help wanted signs from here to the Canadian border, correct, that people need to up their skills a little bit.
Okay. Really good to have your call and your insight from the neighborhood in Minneapolis. Discussion, if you've just gotten in on it, on how to understand gentrification from a research point of view, from a cultural point of view, from the economics of it, and from your experiential point of this. I'm asking you, as our guest, join us this morning about whether you live in a city neighborhood that's been changing and how those changes are affecting you, either positive or negative. Also want to talk with our guest this morning about some research that comes out of Portland State University about gentrification and economic isolation. For as many neighborhoods are gentrifying, there are many, many more that are economically isolated where poverty is deeply embedded. So do the two fit together? How do we think about that? I have a feeling Tyler might have some thoughts on that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2000.
2828 on Twitter at Carrie NPR. And back to the discussion here in just a moment to Stephen John now. Hi, Stephen.
Morning, Carrie. President Trump is announcing a trade understanding with Mexico that could lead to an overhaul of the North American Free Trade Agreement. Trump made the announcement today in the Oval Office with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto joining by speakerphone. Canada, which is part of NAFTA, did not participate in the announcement. Trump says negotiations with Canada have yet to begin. The flags at the White House, which were lowered over the weekend to mark the death of Senator John McCain, are back at full staff. The flags at the U.S. Capitol, meanwhile, remain at half staff to honor McCain, who died Saturday of brain cancer. President Trump tweeted his condolences to McCain's family, but hasn't issued a presidential proclamation with an order lowering U.S. flags. Plans call for McCain to lie in state Wednesday in the Arizona state capitol on what would have been his 82nd birthday. Services are set for Thursday in Phoenix and Saturday in Washington. A Chicago fire department official says some of the children who were among eight people killed in a weekend apartment fire were there for a sleepover. The official said today there was no working smoke detector that would have alerted the victims to the fire that started in a back porch. The cause of the Sunday fire remains under investigation, but there's no sign of foul play. Another drenching storm has inundated parts of southern Wisconsin. The Weather Service says more than 7 inches of rain was reported in parts of Ozaukee and Washington counties in the east. The storm downed trees and caused flooding that closed a portion of Interstate 43 this morning. Up to 1.5 inches of rain fell Sunday on Madison as the city is working to recover from flash flooding last week. The Minnesota forecast includes a good chance of thunderstorms in central and southern areas of the state by later this afternoon. Some could be severe with heavy rainfall, a lesser chance of rain in the north. Time now, 11:38.
Support comes from Allina Health Aetna. Aging actively means being able to do the things you enjoy. That's why Allina Health Aetna offers Medicare plans for the whole you starting this fall. Allina Health Aetna Medicare, aha.medicare101.com.
On the next NPR News presents a debate from the Intelligence Squared series. Are safe spaces at universities a threat to free speech? The debate motion is trigger warning, safe spaces are dangerous. That's coming up Monday at noon and 9 p.m.
What are people listening to on the podcast? Doctors talking to patients about mortality and the political junkie and trivia, political trivia. You can find it on the podcast. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you listen. Back to our conversation now. Brittany Lewis with us from the University of Minnesota. Tyler Sitt with us, pastor at New City Church in Minneapolis. It's a United Methodist church. And I'm going to go right back to the phones here because we have a number of people that want to get in here. To Maureen in Uptown. Ah, Maureen in Uptown. What do you think when you hear people say, I don't want my neighborhood to be uptowned?
Well, I think it's a little frustrating because we owned a, my husband and I owned a house on Lindale, and there was a development or a developer came in to put a big apartment building in, and right across the street, there was a business owner who was vehemently opposed to this. And yet he has his building constantly covered with graffiti. He never shovels the walk in front of his business. It's terribly taken care of. And the developer came in and they take good care of their property. And I appreciate that. And I think all people want to live in neighborhoods that are taken care of, and that people feel like, oh, I'm out here and it's beautiful here, or, you know, and interesting too. And there's all kinds of really wonderful, interesting things about Uptown, but I don't think development is killing Uptown. I think that it helps it become a denser place to live, which is what our city. That's what we're doing. Yeah. We're becoming a denser community, and I think that that's a positive thing.
You've raised something interesting, Maureen, that I want to go back to Brittany on. Brittany, when you talked to people about, again, I think this kind of comes back to the ambivalence of, I don't want buildings in my neighborhood that aren't well taken care of, but, you know, sometimes those are the buildings where there's lower rent. I mean, Did you sense some of this that we've heard from our callers today in these interviews that you did?
Yeah, 100%. The first thing I want to say in relation to all the callers and listeners that are talking or listening to us this conversation is a very racialized conversation that we often don't want to own. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of the uncomfortableness of gentrification, because in short, we're all implicated in it. So we're talking about economics on one level, but then the reality of it is that Minnesota has some of the largest gaps in unemployment in the country between white and black folks. Mm-hmm. We have some of the worst disparities in the country, so gentrification is undoubtedly going to affect low-income folks of color, generally speaking, in ways that it doesn't impact more privileged white families or young professionals. So we're talking about buildings, but we're also talking about race.
Right.
So I, you know, even in my interviews, you know, folks were owning that in many ways. You know, I'd argue, too, that many folks that have been owning buildings for years in disinvested places have done nothing with them. Mm-hmm. And then now that the market has increased, they see a cost benefit to it now. Mm-hmm. So those folks that have been living in those disinvested places who are used to the graffiti or the lack of, you know, options or businesses being in those areas, right, have been the ones subject to not having those amenities for years, right, because they've lived in place in the city that hasn't been disinvested in. So they've had to live with that. So now that there's an influx of capital coming in and there's an influx of needing to appeal to the folks that have the disposable income,
yep,
communities are seeing that change is coming, but it's not coming for me. Because these buildings were left this way for decades, i.e. these are disinvested places that up until there's a desire and need to invest, they weren't getting in amenities that now are coming, but they're not coming for them.
I want to take a call here, Brittany, from a listener, I think, who wants to talk about what you heard, the racialized dimension of this, to Todd in Winona. Hi, Todd.
Hi. Yes, I lived in a neighborhood in a different state that was large, and it was in a larger city, and it was a neighborhood that had declined a lot, and it was entirely white, and in fact, the people there felt strongly about that white identity. And what happened is a large portion of the neighborhood started to become Vietnamese refugees, mm-hmm, Vietnamese Americans. And I saw it as a good thing. I lived there. I thought it was good. They were opening up stores that had been closed. To me, the neighborhood was improving. But I can tell you that the people who lived there, they felt that they were losing their neighborhood. They didn't like it. They felt their culture was being forced to change. And so it just, I didn't agree with them. I don't agree with their attitude, but it just made me start to wonder about who decides that, well, this is a cultural change that's good. Mm-hmm. This is diversity that's good. This is not. That's something I'd like to hear them talk about.
Good question. Todd, I'm sure you talk about this, Tyler, in
yes,
your church discussions over this.
Yes. Thank you, Todd, for the question. I think this analysis is not complete unless we consider the backdrop of power in America. I think that the analysis that you're talking about, Todd, is you're setting these two groups up, or the people you're talking about are setting these two groups up as if they come with equal amounts of power, when a refugee from Vietnam clearly does not have as much social mobility as someone who grew up in the United States when you're living in the United States. So I think that what New City Church is trying to do is to highlight the assets that folks who are traditionally considered marginalized or underprivileged, and really see how those populations are the same ones that make our communities great.
Tyler, is some of this, and this comes up in a lot of discussions that the country has about race, is some of this a zero-sum gain? If I already have this in my neighborhood and those people come in and bring that stuff, somehow I'm going to lose. I mean, I think that's in some ways what our caller was describing. Right. We have this neighborhood, and we own, quote-unquote, this neighborhood. And now you're bringing other people in who don't look like us and don't have an experience like us, and that's going to diminish my experience somehow.
Sure.
Of the neighborhood.
Sure. And I can't speak as much about the rural experience, but I know that in cities, part of the reason why people move to cities is because they want to live in a diverse, abundant place. And so I think we need to start the conversation with the affirmation that immigrants and refugee populations almost always make communities stronger and more appealing to the very reason why people move to cities in the first place.
Brittany, do you want to add something to that?
100%. I feel like this is so reminiscent of just our history of housing, where, you know, for instance, you know, redlining determined which neighborhoods were going to get, you know, mortgages or not. Mm-hmm. Predominantly white neighborhoods would, or neighborhoods of color would not. Or when too many folks of color moved into a white neighborhood, then white folks would move out because this fear of proximity or fear of that tipping point. So we're having the same discussion, but in a very different context. So, like, how much diversity is good enough to make us feel comfortable about the diversity that we feel like we need? And unfortunately, white folks with capital get to decide that.
Yeah. I want you both to weigh in a bit here on this thing I mentioned before we went to news about many neighborhoods stuck in economic isolation as well. I mean, for all the attention on gentrification, I was reading this research out of Portland State, and here's one of the conclusions from the study. There are important indirect effects of having well-educated neighbors. We often lose sight of the fact that education is a social multiplier. Having well-educated neighbors generates more economic activity, making communities more productive and more resilient in the face of economic change, which produces benefits for everyone. I mean, this study, Brittany, is investigating. You have a lot of neighborhoods that are isolated economically, and gentrification might actually be a good thing in some of these neighborhoods. How do you account for that?
I mean, again, I can say that there's not one neighborhood that I've been in and done interviews in where folks wanted to benefit from that kind of change. I would argue, for instance, in the North Minneapolis clusters that we did interviews within, folks have been fighting for these changes years and years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted these developments before, asked for these things to come. So what then does it mean when those changes don't come as a result of you working with the city or trying to build relationships with the city, but the result of other financial or economic interests? And those interests then in turn make it challenging for you to even afford to stay.
Right.
There's this question of belonging that a lot of folks talked about. So the question of displacement beyond physical, folks are feeling like, I no longer belong if my kind of efforts in trying to work with the city and trying to bring things for folks that are in place and have been in place for decades don't galvanize any form of change. It's clear to me the city's not interested in working with me. They're interested in working with those that can financially, shift things. So that creates a very folks question the city and their interest.
Tyler?
They should.
Yeah, I think that there's a dominant narrative in this conversation that proximity to educated whiteness is what's going to save a neighborhood. And what we find really across the country is that when neighborhoods are able to create an economic development within themselves and able to educate people who grew up in that neighborhood, that's when truly lasting sustainable change happens.
So I want to make sure I understand what you said. The issue here is that the perception changes when more white people move into a neighborhood and suddenly it's seen as an economically viable place. It attracts investment.
Right. And I just think as far as the Portland State University research goes, that education absolutely is an amazing thing for economic development. And I think it's not a fair statement to say that education necessarily comes from outsiders who are a different race from the neighborhood.
One more thing out of this study that I'd like you guys to comment on. Much attention gets directed to instances of dramatic neighborhood changes in the form of gentrification. Once high poverty neighborhoods experience a large reduction in poverty rates, but the reverse is also true. Some urban neighborhoods that once had low levels of poverty have experienced a large increase in poverty. Brittany, does that?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Our quantitative analysis, and I argue it's been one of the most kind of important interventions that our research has found. That is the case in some census tracts here in the Twin Cities, where there is an increase in poverty on one end, but then there's a huge increase in affluence on the other.
Uh-huh.
And I think that now we're talking about the inequity taking place. So there are four different typologies that our study has come up with. And in many ways, we describe places that have gentrified, where the population of poverty has decreased, but there's also places where it has gentrified and the population of poverty has increased, while on the top end, affluence and those with higher incomes have increased simultaneously. So that means the inequity and the gap have increased.
A question here, Tyler, from a listener on Twitter who says, how do your guests feel about the Hispanic community that moved into and saved East Lake Street several years ago? Is this gentrification?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when we look historically into East Lake Street, it was a lot of African-American and Latinx organizers who came together to put in bike lanes, create the Midtown Global Market, shut down one of their factories that was giving kids asthma. Mm-hmm. So I think...
But is that how you would define gentrification? And is that...
No. I really wouldn't, because I think that, again, gentrification, the conversation of gentrification necessarily must include a racial analysis. And when we consider... immigrants from Central and South America, they're coming from a position of less social power than the white folks who are now moving into the neighborhood and displacing those same Latinx people.
Call here from Sarah in South Minneapolis. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Hi. I was just going to throw in another consideration.
Okay.
That gentrification with the racial context, but they're, you know, as opposed to urban renewal. Where I am, I wouldn't say that I live in an area between 35W and Nicollet, just south of Kingfield Park. Actually, we have more diversification than when I first moved here 45 years ago. As an artist, I'm very grateful that I have a place to live,
mm-hmm.
because I have... been very involved in renovating studio spaces and apartments, and then they get... Artists tend to be the bottom line of gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
We move into an obsolete area of town, and then you bring it up to whatever standards you need to be able to work, and then the designer types, the archetype types, and the higher powers that have more money tend to move in, and then artists move on to another obsolete neighborhood. I've given up on the warehouse district years ago. I work and live in my house, but as a senior citizen now who has been retired for 3 years, I am grateful for the new restaurants. I'm grateful for the continuing diversity. I'm grateful for the ever-increasing families, but I worry about the property taxes,
right.
The ability, you know, because those of us who are senior citizens and have lived here for decades have now put in a lot of elbow grease, have invested in our homes. Our homes are now paid off. So on the plus side, we're benefiting from the price increase. But on the downside, we have no place to go if we can't afford to stay here.
You've really just put the hour discussion into a nutshell there, Sarah. I mean,
and, you know, the next step, I mean, as I say to my family and friends, my intention is to be hauled out of here feet first, because otherwise, you know, you're going to have to sell in order to pay for what? Assisted living, nursing home, which is skyrocketing along with everything else.
Yeah.
And most of us here who are senior citizens don't eat at the restaurants on a regular basis. It's and you know, I know there's definitely a white racial element here, but it's not all white racial
okay.
element. It's,
yeah.
it's the people who have the six-figure incomes who can, and those are not the people who start, this is a working-class first family dwelling. I mean,
Sarah, I want to give Tyler a chance to get in here. I really appreciate the insight here coming from your experience.
Yeah, Sarah, thank you for that input. I think that New City did a sermon series that was resonant to this. We did a sermon series on the book How to Kill a City by Peter Moskowitz, and in it he lays out six stages of gentrification to kind of complexify the narrative that it's only white hipsters who are coming in to displace people of color. And in fact, what we see on the continuum of gentrification is people of color, as well as low-income artists, low-income working folks, working against their neighborhood being sold out to developers and investors, some of whom aren't even in the state or country. And so the title, How to Kill a City, comes from the idea of all of our cities inevitably moving towards what we see in Manhattan, where Shanghai investors are buying properties that they never visit, unless there's significant intervention on the community and political level.
Let me see if I can get one more call in here from Tom in Marine on St. Croix. So, Tom, what occurs to you from listening to this conversation?
Well, you know, I live out in Marine, so I'm out, you know, 30 minutes out from town. But what are the answers here to this? Because I like going into Minneapolis and seeing all the small businesses that are not chains and the diversity in the distinct neighborhoods that are out there. And it's kind of sad when you see them going the way of, you know, the big coffee and the big this and the big
right,
that. So
right.
What is the answer? How do we get our legislatures and our people that are in power to make the right decisions and to invest in these neighborhoods and build them up with the people that are already in there via education, via decent jobs, via, you know, I'm a conservative, but I also see that there needs to be a lot of help in these neighborhoods.
I think this is something, Tyler, you're wrestling with the congregation. So what have you come up with?
Absolutely. So as part of the Make Homes Happen Coalition, we again want to take a three-prong approach of preservation, production, and protection. Preservation of existing affordable housing, production of new affordable housing, as well as protection of the renters who are creating the fun places that you love to visit. I also want to give a shout out that the mayor and the Minneapolis City Council has increased their funding for affordable housing based off of the advocacy of folks like the Coalition of Make Homes Happen. So there's definitely, we're seeing political will for people to speak up for affordable housing and for politicians to make policy that's resonant with that. But it requires all of us, not just the folks who are most affected on the ground, but all of us who are speaking to our political representatives.
Tyler, thanks very much for being here. Good to meet you.
Thank you.
And have you here in studio. Brittany, thank you so much for the time and the benefit of your research. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Let me mention this, too. We've done a number of shows fairly recently on affordable housing, including one with members of the Minneapolis City Council, and Mayor Fry weighed in on this. So you can find them in the podcast. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller and then look for those shows on affordable housing.